Hello and welcome to the Securities Compliance Podcast presented by the National Society of Compliance Professionals, where it is our mission to help you put compliance in context. I'm your host, Patrick Hayes, partner at the Calfee Law Firm. And on today's show, we will be providing a comprehensive deep dive look at SEC enforcement over the last 12 months, including the real story behind some of the recent numbers, distinct areas of focus, and what we're hearing from the Paul Atkins-led SEC. To help guide us through this important topic and share some fantastic insights for our listeners, we welcome in two expert panelists and accomplished podcasters, Andrew Dean from Weil Gotshal and Kurt Wolf from Quinn Emanuel. The interview with Andrew and Kurt was exceptional and went even longer than I anticipated. And given the importance of the subject matter and the fantastic content produced, we structured this show as another installment of our Lessons from the Frontline series. We've talked about these shows before, but for some of our new listeners, the Lessons from the Frontline series focus on real-life, tough-to-tackle subjects that other industry professionals and regulators have faced on the front lines of our industry. And if you're anything like me, you've probably noticed the marked decline in enforcement activity this year and had quite a few questions on your mind. So, to help provide some clarity on these matters, I know the best thing for me to do at this point is get up and out of the way. And so with that, let's dive into the interview with Andrew and Kurt. As we move into the interview session of today's show, we're going to be diving into one of those subjects that is always a fan favorite here in the compliance space, namely diving into what's happening on the SEC enforcement front. And joining us today, I am thrilled about an august panel we have, including Andrew Dean from the Weil Gotshal firm, as well as Kurt Wolf from Quinn Emanuel. Andrew joined Weil as a partner back in February of this year after 12 years at the SEC, where he was most recently the co-chief of the asset management unit in the Division of Enforcement. And he is a new all-star, rising star in the podcasting world with the Asset Management Corner podcast run by him and colleague Chris Mulligan, also friend of the podcast here. And we are also incredibly pleased to welcome in Kurt Wolf, who's a partner in Quinn Emanuel's SEC enforcement practice and commodities and derivatives group, where he specializes in government and internal investigations, regulatory enforcement, and securities litigation. I should also, I would be bereft if I didn't mention that Kurt Wolf was also a podcast host and someone who I took inspiration from back when the Securities Compliance podcast was getting off and running. Kurt hosted the Insecurities podcast on PLI for many years and produced a ton of great content. I may just get up and leave and let you guys do the show, if that's cool.
I'm just excited that Kurt retired from doing this, because now we are no longer, would have been the third ranked. Now we get to be second ranked Securities Compliance podcast to you, Patrick. So we're all good to go here.
Yeah. Yeah, and I am going to ask you to stick around, Patrick. I think things will go a lot smoother with you at the helm. I'm not in practice. I've been out of this business for a few months now, so I'm going to need a hand.
And we had Patrick on our podcast recently, so I'm very appreciative that he had me on his. So we're doing a home and away here.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, I'm excited about diving into our subject matter today with you two, because this is definitely, I think, an item that a lot of people are really interested in. I think there's certainly been some changes that we've seen in the SEC enforcement space over the past year. And obviously with your experience as, you know, a recent regulator and kind of from that standpoint, and then your experience, Kurt, you know, on the private practice side and some of the things that you're seeing from the industry, I think this will just be a really, really awesome discussion. So again, thank you both truly so much for coming on the show today. Really excited to dive in. Yeah, as we kind of open things up, I think it would be good to maybe do a little bit of a level set at the top. And so the last 12 months in the enforcement space, I think there's been quite a lot of, I don't know, movement, volatility up and down. I would really be interested in maybe, you know, Andrew, maybe I'll pick on you to start. You know, talk to us a little bit about what's been happening in the enforcement space over the past 12 months. And, you know, what are some of the things that we're seeing? How would you kind of break that down?
Yeah. So, you know, the SEC's fiscal year runs October 1 through September 30, and we don't have the final numbers yet from that period. Our friends at Cornerstone always put out a nice report at the end of the year that kind of, you know, tell the story. It will be a little complicated by the fact that this fiscal year was over the course of two commissions that have relatively different approaches to enforcement. And so the first 3.5 months of the fiscal year were under Chair Gensler, and the remaining were under interim Chair Ueda and then Chair Atkins. You know, it's clear that the enforcement actions are dramatically lower under the Atkins Commission. If we just look at the period, this is our friends at King and Spalding put out this, and we're giving a lot of credit to others who have kind of done the math for us. Between February and July of 2025, there were 67 enforcement actions. Compare that to 198 enforcement actions during the same time period in 2021 when there was another commission transition. And there's reasons for this. You know, first of all, the staff numbers are down. There are just, you know, fewer people at the SEC. There were a record number of cases that were brought at the end of the fiscal year. Third, there's been a lot of recalibration, I think, within enforcement. There have been a lot of statements that this Chairman Atkins has made and the commissioners have made about the interests in enforcement in retail and other things and focus on frauds and insider trading. And I think the staff is trying to calibrate what that means in terms of actual enforcement actions. I think morale has been an issue. I think between DOGE and everything else going on in the world, I do think, you know, it's harder to do your job when you're worried about having your job. And I think there was also what we did not see, which was interesting, was there was no push to the finish. Every September, the SEC staff gets super busy in bringing enforcement actions over the finish line. And that happened, you know, under the Clayton Commission, the Gensler Commission, the White Commission. We did not see that this year, though. So those are some of the reasons why I think we saw a significant slowdown in enforcement actions coming. We could talk more about it. I think the cases that are coming out are fairly representative of what came out previously. But if you talk about pure numbers, that's, I think, a little bit of the story.
Yeah, no, that's really great background. You know, Kurt, anything to add to that and maybe any other points that you'd like to bring up?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'll dive into the numbers a little bit. I've been doing this for years now. Some people enjoy looking at it through a quantitative lens. Some don't. Those are typically the people on the staff in senior officer positions. I know there have been some over the years that really don't like talking about the statistics. But I mean, I largely agree with what Andrew said. I just want to put it in context a little bit, right? So if we go back in time just a couple of years, if we look back at fiscal year 2022, the SEC brought 760 enforcement actions. In fiscal 2023, that number ticked up a bit to 784. I think that was the second highest number of enforcement actions in any given fiscal year in history. Andrew, jump in if I got that wrong, but it's up there. Let's say it's top three for sure. What we saw last year was, I think some predicted that there was going to be a fall off. We actually saw it just completely go off a cliff, right? So for fiscal 2024, the total number of actions was 583. That was a 26% decline from the year before. And as far as I can tell, it was a historically low figure. I've actually tried to dig into these numbers a couple different times. And as far back as I can go, you know, when the SEC was reporting enforcement statistics, you have to go before the financial crisis in, you know, 2008, 2009 to get back into the 500s. Now, last year after that number came out, I cautioned people not to take a sky is falling view. I pointed back to, you know, sort of a transition year between 2019 and 2020, where there was a 17% drop off in the number of enforcement cases. And my view was that we were likely to see enforcement activity rebound. We have not seen that. I agree with Andrew. I think the numbers are actually going to go down again this year. Now, I maybe am not quite as bearish as Andrew. I actually suspect that we'll get close to 500 enforcement actions this year, but that is because The SEC's Division of Enforcement had a gangbusters first quarter. In fact, it caused them to take the unusual, maybe unprecedented step of releasing an interim report on what the Division of Enforcement had been up to. In the middle of January, the Division of Enforcement issued a press release that said in the first quarter, they brought 200 plus enforcement actions. And as of the middle of January, they brought another 40 or so. I continued to kind of dig into the numbers myself a little bit. And what I see is, like, I think King and Spalding has got it pretty right. Although I think people count enforcement actions a little bit differently, but it took a little while for those numbers to tail off. And so I think when you look back across the year, when you bring in, you know, the 12 J's and some of the other things that always kind of tick up the numbers in ways that we don't really pay attention to, I'm guessing, my own personal guess, you can have me on this time next year and make fun of me, Patrick. I'm guessing 500-ish.
Okay. Andrew, anything?
That's the over-under, I guess. I don't know. I don't know that I want to put money, lay money on that. Yeah, look, I'll just say, look, I think I would think that until now, because I think there is, in this commission, I think there is a de-emphasis on the number of cases and more of an emphasis on what you are bringing, like the quality and the, you know, the substance. But I will tell you, even back, you know, look, even during the last Trump administration, the Clayton Commission, I mean, at the time, they were outpacing the prior commission, the White Commission, in bringing actions. And I think you guys well know there was like a year where of all the actions brought, there were like over 100 12B1 share class cases under right. The Clayton Commission. So it depends on where you see sweeps and kind of initiatives. Mm-hmm. If there are no sweeps and initiatives under this commission, I think we will definitely see a dramatic shortfall of enforcement action.
Yeah.
I'll actually be interested. Something I've been thinking about is what level of transparency we're going to get into the enforcement numbers. And across the board, I think Chairman Atkins is all about being transparent as a regulator and certainly encourages the Division of Enforcement to be transparent. But there's always this tension about whether the extent to which we should talk about, focus on the numbers. And you're right, Andrew. I mean, in a speech a couple of weeks ago, Chairman Atkins was saying, look, I don't want to create this perverse incentive structure where the staff is thinking about how many cases did I bring. I want them to think about the quality of the cases. And importantly, I don't recall a chairman ever saying this before, but I think people should be rewarded for exercising their judgment not to bring cases in appropriate circumstances. And so I just wonder at the end of the day if that leads to a situation where we see a different kind of reporting, or maybe the numbers aren't the thing that we focus on. Every other year, the first sentence in the press release is how many actions they brought, right? I don't know if we're going to see that for the next few years.
That's a really good thought, and actually a really good segue, Kurt. It's almost like you've done this before. This is awesome. One of the things I know I really wanted to talk about today, because Chair Atkins, obviously, certainly, you know, with the change in regime and the administration, there's obviously going to be different priorities, right, that he's going to have, and kind of some of the things that he's going to be focused on. And even, like, exactly to your point, Kurt, kind of the process and perspective and the lens in which he wants to view how enforcement gets done. And so I'd be just really interested kind of more broadly to hear from you both. What are we hearing from Atkins? And I know he actually, I think, recently gave a speech, a keynote address, where he was talking about kind of the Wells process and some of these different items. But, you know, I'd love to hear kind of what are we hearing directly from Chair Atkins, both from the enforcement side and even then more specifically, maybe like the Wells process.
So because we're doing this on a podcast, we're sort of like first to press and talking about, I think, that speech on the Wells process. I haven't seen too much out there yet, but it's a really great topic for us to be discussing and very timely. The Wells process, for those who may be unfamiliar with it, because you fortunately have avoided enforcement actions or activity before, allows parties who were under investigation, when they get to the end, to submit a statement to the commission explaining their interests and position with respect to why there should not be charges brought in the case. And the idea of the Wells process was to allow not just the enforcement staff to advocate for why charges should be brought, even settled charges should be brought, but it gave potential defendants the ability as well to advocate for their position. The Wells process has always been discretionary by the staff. And there has been, though, some guidance that was provided in the public-facing enforcement manual about when to give a Wells notice. That included when the Wells notice might put a potential defendant on notice of a possible asset freeze or might disrupt a parallel investigation. So there was some kind of loose guidance out there. But ultimately, and as I think, you know, Kirk could probably attest to, I think there was a region-by-region, unit-by-unit determination of whether a Wells process was appropriate in a given case. And yes, no cases are the same, but I do think that there probably was a level of inconsistency across the enforcement division about when the Wells process was happening. So there were two things I would say, like there were some parts of the speech that were, I think, explained traditionally how the Wells process has worked, but there were a couple of new things that are worth mentioning. So what's the same in terms of Chairman Atkins's speech? First, senior leadership will meet with defense counsel. As far as I know, that's always happened. It's not always been the case that the enforcement director or the deputy director has taken those meetings historically. Not sure what that's going to mean in this commission because his speech focused on senior leadership. We're not sure who he's referring to just yet. He said that early engagement on a white paper basis is encouraged. That's basically a Wells process, but without triggering the notification requirements, perhaps under a Wells, an actual Wells process. And I'll tell you that when I was at the commission, I did way more Wells processes. I did way more white paper processes than I ever did Wells processes. So the white paper is oftentimes where a lot of cases get resolved through a potential resolution. And he also made the point that the Wells process may not always be practical, and that's kind of always been the case. But what are the changes that I think we will see? 4 weeks for a response. So that's actually kind of a new statement. Now, I think, and Kurt will jump in like and give his view on it. As a general matter, like giving extensions was something that our group would, like my group would always do, unless there were compelling reasons not to. Like if you had a parallel criminal action or there was some other timing issue, or whether there was an extensive white paper process that happened, which kind of converts into a Wells process. Otherwise, like for the most part, I think extensions were given, but to the extent they were not given previously, that is going to change. People will get 4 weeks now, it sounds like. The other part that I think was, and this to me is the most significant, is encouraging the staff to share the investigative file. I don't know the extent to which that message was as well accepted and received and told to staff previously. And I think, you know, I think that's helpful because I think for there to be a resolution in a case, I think you have to understand what the facts and the law are. And so each party can kind of come up with their expected value of a resolution. And I think the closer they are, the more likely you are to get resolution. And so I think it's helpful for, I think, both the staff and for the defendants to get more information in the file. I don't think they're initially going to get everything, but I think they're going to get important transcripts. They're going to get information proper to them that may be relevant to the case, even if it's not in the written record. I think that's probably a helpful step for everybody involved.
Yeah, I agree with that, particularly as it relates to the investigative file. I mean, I can tell you, you know, from my experience doing this kind of work for quite a while now, you don't always get it. And in fact, there seems to be sometimes different approaches or practices depending on what team you're working with or what office the staff are in. You know, I've been told by certain offices, like as a policy matter, we don't do that. And I'm like, well, that's interesting because some others do, as a policy matter, make that information available, right? So I think that this came from the top is interesting and important from a process perspective. I will note, you know, I don't know that there is a whole lot different, you know, other than I agree with you, the 4 weeks in the investigative file. If you go back to 2007, you'll actually find that then Commissioner Atkins gave a speech. It was also at the AA Summer Junior Corporate Securities and Financial Law Seminar, and he talked for probably half an hour about the Wells process and where he thought it worked well and where he thought there could be improvements. This year's speech is very similar, I would say, at least in terms of themes. I would just flag some things that I thought were really interesting about this speech that are unrelated to the Wells process. There are little nuggets in there that I think tell us, or at least confirm for us, what Chairman Atkins thinks about the role of SEC enforcement. I mean, he always will say, I think you can go back and read through all his speeches, never will you find him say it's anything other than critical, important, significant, necessary, right? He is a fan of the SEC enforcement division, provided that it is bounded by fairness, due process, proportionality, discretion, things like that. So it's just four points I think came out of this speech for me. One related to integrity and fairness, right? Chairman Atkins wants the SEC's division of enforcement to aggressively pursue quote unquote real fraud, or I've seen people call it clean fraud, right? Like the things that anyone would look at and say, yeah, that's an example of lying, cheating, and stealing, right? Absolutely. You know, full steam ahead on those matters. But he would also, I think, encourage them to prioritize their resources thoughtfully or appropriately, right? So the second point for me is prioritization. They should focus on cases where there's a lot of harm to investors or potential harm to investors, and not just technical violations, not foot faults. I think many would say that's a different tone or strategy than what we saw in the last administration. He even went out of his way to say SEC enforcement should never feel like a gotcha game. My third point would be transparency and predictability. I think, again, this is sort of consistent with what we've heard from Chairman Atkins, you know, back when he was a commissioner even. He thinks enforcement action should be consistent, that results should be fairly predictable and tied to SEC policies and coordinated across the divisions. I think that in part plays into the recent decision to say that you could take waiver and enforcement outcomes to the commission simultaneously and kind of get one decision. And then the last piece, we've talked about it a little bit, but it's this concept of incentives and judgment, right? He wants to encourage the staff to use their discretion appropriately, not always to say, oh, you know, we've been stuck in on this case for 2 years, so we've got to get an outcome here, but in appropriate circumstances to say, we've learned enough, we're going to walk away from this one.
Yeah. One, super, super helpful context. And man, Kurt, what a great pull on the speech from 2007. The fact that I think we just had like our own Back to the Future moment for the first time on the podcast, 18 years apart. That's phenomenal. But no, I mean, what you shared about, you know, how your Chair Atkins is really viewing these and bringing it down like that. And obviously you can really start to get a good feel for what his kind of core principles are. I do very much appreciate, you know, and I think it's important, and we would all agree it's important to have a really strong, clear kind of, you know, SEC enforcement that is out there helping to protect the integrity of the marketplace. But obviously we want to make sure that it's balanced and has, and it itself, right, uses discretion when it can, depending on the types of cases that it's going to bring and the focus areas and the priorities from the staff. But knowing a little bit about what we've heard from Chair Atkins, you know, what are we hearing from some of the other commissioners? And, you know, maybe Kurt, I'll start with you on this one. Commissioner Peirce, Commissioner Ueda, Commissioner Crenshaw, you know, what are some of the other things that we're hearing from some of the other commissioners? Or have we heard a different focus from them? Or has it pretty much been kind of falling in line with what Chair Atkins has said?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is we haven't heard a lot from the other commissioners on enforcement since Chairman Atkins, you know, took the big chair. I think, you know, if we think about Commissioners Ueda, Peirce, and Crenshaw, we've been listening to them, reading their speeches for years. I think their views on enforcement are pretty well known. That said, I would note that all three of them gave remarks at SEC Speaks in May this year, and all of them touched on enforcement. I think it was the focus of all of their speeches at SEC Speaks. And, you know, unsurprisingly, perhaps Commissioners Ueda and Peirce, their remarks were really aligned with Chairman Atkins. You know, if we look at the speech from, you know, early this month for Chairman Atkins, they hit on a lot of the same themes. So all three of the commissioners agree that enforcement should focus on real harm and the core investor protection mission. They all agree that enforcement should not be used as a tool to expand the regulatory scope or to clarify vague laws or rules. They all agree that you should have a fair process and that enforcement actions and penalties should be proportional to the alleged misconduct. And they all agree that staff incentives should be aligned with quality and not quantity, right? Now, that's super high level. I bet if I read that list to Commissioner Crenshaw, she would probably agree with those things the way I just said them. I think where she differs is maybe a little bit in a sort of pivot or a change, I think, in terms of priorities, right? So she gave a speech at SEC Speaks as well, where she sort of worried about the commission chipping away at decades of work. And she said, you know, quote, she's deeply troubled by the commission's abandonment of swaths of our enforcement program, end quote. So I think what she is speaking to is, you know, the sentiment that we've heard from a lot of folks, and that Andrew and I think is probably going to be borne out in the numbers, that there's just going to be less enforcement. And I think for someone like Commissioner Crenshaw, who's always been, I'll call her a little bit hawkish, and I don't mean that in a bad way when it comes to enforcement, but I think if she sees an environment where there's going to be less enforcement, she views that as maybe a bad thing for the markets. But I think in terms of sort of like principles and focus areas, the commissioners, the Republican commissioners, are aligned with Chairman Atkins and haven't really said anything that I think changes my view of how they see the world.
Yeah, I'll just layer in that, well, one observation is it does feel like very shortly we're going to have zero Democratic commissioners, which so I think we're going to start stop seeing any dissents or other viewpoints on some of these topics, which I think is unfortunate, because I think both sides, like when they're in the minority, should have an important voice. Then it could help shape enforcement actions. They can help shape the program. They can help shape the way the market thinks about things, even with their dissents. So I think we'll kind of miss that voice. The other comment I'll make is, when it comes to enforcement actions, and we'll talk about this more, I know we're going to talk about, get into the meat of it a little bit. I tend to look at the commission votes as being the real way that the commission talks to us through, like, what kind of actions they would support. Because I think, like, if you take out crypto cases and off-channel communication cases, I haven't done the numbers on this. Kurt sounds like the numbers guy, but I would bet you that there would be a substantial number of those cases, like significant majority of those cases would be 5-0 or 4-1 votes in the last commission. And that's across a lot of different categories, including technical violations, which I'll talk about. So I think sometimes there's kind of what you give in a speech, and yes, they don't want to see like a million off-channel communication cases. We're not going to see that again. Obviously, like, you know, the crypto cases and the way that entire body of law kind of developed, like, we're not going to see something like that again. There is a deregulatory, there is a harmonization with the CFTC component to all of this. I get it. But I do think that the cases that we're going to see are going to be similar to the cases we saw previously. I just think there will be less of them. I mean, there are going to be some categories that are evergreen. We'll talk, you know, the fraud stuff we'll talk about. But it's going to be hard to allocate too many more resources to those than they already are.
I agree with that. And I would also just underscore, I think it's a great point about having diverse views on the commission, right? I mean, when I was hosting the Insecurities podcast, we were fortunate to have, I think, all of the sitting commissioners while we were hosting the show. And one thing that they all remarked on, you know, whether on or off mic, was how valuable the interaction was between the commissioners and among the commissioner's staff. You know, I remember Rob Jackson in particular saying, you know, like, look, Jay Clayton and I don't agree on some things, but the dialogue that we have about it is really important. And there are final rulemakings that were shaped through, you know, that sort of polite disagreement, whether it was between, you know, Jay and Rob or their staff. And when that goes away, I do think it changes the dynamic of the commission in meaningful and probably not helpful ways.
Yeah. You know, here, completely agree. And I very much appreciate both of your perspectives on that. And, you know, hopefully we can continue to have a really good, positive and constructive dialogue where there are, differing opinions on certain matters. But, you know, obviously we'll keep our eye on that, and certainly any additional comments from all of the active commissioners here in the weeks and months to come. Well, another item that I wanted to touch on that certainly has been a really, you know, higher profile topic this year. Obviously, you mentioned DOGE earlier, Andrew, and there's been some meaningful cuts certainly at the federal level with regard to the SEC. I'm sure that enforcement does not get carved out of that, and in fact has been the recipient of some of those cuts. You know, without getting into maybe some of the nuts and bolts of the cuts themselves, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, you know, like just from a process standpoint, right? What kind of happens during that time frame? You know, what in you know, we'll go to you, Andrew. Would love to hear your thoughts. What typically happens during a transition when you have a change in administration and from a kind of when you have significant cuts happening? What are some of the other things happening inside enforcement?
Yeah, great question. And so, as a general matter, division directors either step down or are asked to step down. That's just traditionally what has happened. And, you know, so that, because I think for the you know, what we refer to as the policymaking division, so investment management, trading and markets, the folks who are going to be doing rulemaking, you know, the new commissioner typically wants their own people to kind of frame that. And then similar with enforcement, usually they want to put their own person in place. Exams can kind of go different ways. Like I've seen it replacement, I've seen not in the past. So you would typically get, and as happened here, we, you know, had a transition, and actually here we went a very long time without having a permanent enforcement director. We had Sam Walden for a time. Sam was the deputy. He was the acting enforcement director. Sam is a wonderful person. He was fantastic for the staff. He is very well respected by all the commissioners. Everyone, I think, externally who dealt with him appreciated his demeanor, how he handled cases. He's a very smart, thoughtful guy. He was great. But at the same time, he knew he was not running enforcement long term. And I think he was not probably able to give the staff all the guidance that they wanted or needed in terms of what kind of cases this commission was going to want. And I think that explains some of the slowdown. Now we have a permanent enforcement director. And I think things will pick up a little bit. And I think we actually did see in the last couple months, we saw a little bit more flow of cases that might have been edgier cases, I'll say, cases where people were not sure if they were going to get brought under this commission. So I think that's probably one of the, you know, the biggest things is I think that, you know, you've got the transition in leadership with an enforcement combined with, you know, the cuts, people concerned about their jobs. And I think that's why you see the slowdown. And Kurt may be right. We may start seeing kind of more of a ramp up. You know, I'll tell you that on the investigation side, I've seen a lot more investigations. I've heard from others about more investigations in the last month or so, as if like there's been sort of more of a signal internally to start pursuing certain things. So that remains to be seen. But I do think that there was, you know, there's a slowdown in every transition. Doesn't matter, you know, which side is transitioning to or from. But this one, I think, took a little bit longer because of these additional factors.
Yeah. Kurt, anything to add to that?
Yes, just as soon as my dog stops barking.
Bring him on. We'll add a fourth.
Yeah, absolutely. No, look, I mean, Andrew, I agree that there is always a slowdown in any transition, and you can go back and do look at the stats. Anytime there's a switch, the numbers go down for 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, and you know, the following fiscal year report typically has a lower number than the year before. I think, you know, what we're talking about here is whether we are now officially in sort of like a down cycle and how staffing might impact that. I think, you know, within the division, they've taken some steps over the last few months to try to streamline some things. I think whether that's in recognition of the fact that there has been some attrition and they need to do things more efficiently or whether there are other reasons behind that, you know, it remains to be seen whether those things are going to work and help the staff sort of maximize their ability to investigate and bring cases. And we will see those numbers start ticking up. It's hard to say. I still think the numbers aren't going to be quite as bad as everybody expects. And I agree with you, Andrew, that they'll start ticking back up.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, and I want to stay on one of the points that you made there, Kurt, because I think it's a really apt one for people to understand. Because obviously, look, today, the focus of our conversation has been around enforcement and what some of those numbers look like. But I think it's interesting because, you know, when we talk about the distinction between exams and enforcement, and obviously, look, there are, you know, SEC examinations. Some of those are routine. Some of those are for cause. Ultimately, some of those audits that occur may ultimately get escalated and move into enforcement. But then separately, you know, enforcement can just do kind of inquiries on their own and have kind of do an examination or a fact finding audit or whatever else on its own. And it's interesting, you know, one of the things Andrew mentioned that we recently were on the WOW podcast together. And while we were doing that, one of the things we talked about was how I've seen anecdotally in the industry, examinations are staying pretty high. The volume, the number of exams that are being conducted, and kind of the, whether it's part of the NBE program, right, and the newer registrants that are getting hit, or whether it's existing advisors that have been in place for a while. I think both of those, again, so some of the kind of anecdotal metrics we're seeing are have been pretty flat to neutral and maybe even ticked up a little tiny bit over the past couple months. But then you've had kind of enforcement, which, you know, again, kind of has consistently been a little bit down. We talked about some of those reasons today, although we may see a little bit of a rise here now that we have kind of a more permanent director. Can you also maybe, Kurt, if you don't mind, you know, talk a little bit about kind of some of the distinction between exams and enforcement, and in particular, you know, how you're seeing some exams being resolved right now. Are you seeing fewer or more referrals, right? And just kind of the approach from the exam staff versus the kind of enforcement side.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think at bottom, the stakes are often a little bit different in exams versus in enforcement, right? I mean, no one wants to get a deficiency letter and have to deal with that process, but it's a little bit different than, you know, having an enforcement action.
Right.
You know, the worst case scenario, I think, in an exam is that you get a deficiency letter and a referral to enforcement, right? And now you're sort of refighting the same fight again. You know, we chatted about this a couple of weeks ago, and I asked around a little bit to try to get a sense, like, what is going on with exams? And I agree with you. It does seem like, if anything, there has been an increase in the SEC's examination activities, you know, over the last year, and in 2025 as well. You know, I think they're focusing on things we might expect. You can always go back and look at the exam priorities letter, and I find the exams hew pretty closely to that. But, you know, looking at things like fiduciary duty, standards of conduct, cybersecurity, artificial intelligence has played an outside role, I think, in exams and enforcement over the last, I don't know, 12 or 18 months. I suspect that's what we're going to continue to see. What I think is maybe a little bit different is the potential outcome from exams, right? So if I think back again to SEC Speaks, you know, one of the deputy directors who will remain nameless on one of the panels noted that where in exams they are finding issues that are appropriately remediated, that referrals are unlikely. And that same person went on to say that they are really going to focus less in enforcement on referrals from exams that don't involve something that is fraudy, right? So if you've got a technical violation and for whatever reason it gets kicked to enforcement, if it doesn't sort of tick the fraud box, they may, I'm not saying they're never going to take it up, but they're much less likely. And so I think, at, you know, from my perspective, what that does is create an opportunity for regulated entities that maybe, you know, they have an exam scheduled or they're in an exam right now. There's a real opportunity to remediate potential deficiencies, right? Or maybe even raise some to the staff's attention and try to get it cleaned up, right? This is the time. I think a lot of times in an exams context, you're really hoping to avoid a problem with the staff for obvious reasons. But this could be an opportunity to do a little bit of house cleaning in a context where you are much less concerned about the referral to enforcement.
Yeah, I'll just lay. So it's super interesting. I heard that same speech. I kind of think back. Number one, like, I'll say, yes, 100% remediate during the exam phase. I'll tell you, like, I, like, in my position in the asset management unit, there are very few times that I can remember a situation where there was full remediation and enforcement moving forward on it. I think it happens. I think if there's a custody rule violation, that's they're just going to bring that case like that, because that's and you see, like, Commissioners Person, Ueda support those cases. Those are always 5-0 cases. There's certain things that are just so fundamental to the advisory space that they're just going to bring those cases. I think what I think is hard, Kurt, is I think oftentimes enforcement has a different view and exams is a different view of what should be remediated. And so if you have a different view of what should be remediated, then I think that's enough for that enforcement investigation to open. And so that might be where there's some more line drawing, is what's sufficient remediation, because there are certain things that, you know, can happen, cannot happen. I mean, you take cases involving, there's a lot of private fund advisor cases out there involving post-commitment management fees. As a general matter, like, if that involves a lot of money, you may not want to be paying that money back as a remediation, whereas the exam staff, enforcement staff may think you should have done that. You take cases involving conflicts of interest about how your FAs were compensated. And if there was a conflict on that, I don't know that there's a way during the exam to remediate that. I just think that there's a lot of things that are difficult to remediate during the course of an exam that will otherwise not lead to an enforcement referral. I think when advisors have the ability to do it, they should do it. And not everyone has that experience, I'm sure, Kurt, on the advisory side. And Patrick, you would know too, like, where things were fully remediated and it still went to an enforcement. You know, like, I tend to agree that if that does happen, there's no optimal time where those cases will probably not go to enforcement. I just don't know how much significant that is compared to the past, but it is a very good message to get out to people that if you remediate, you will be in much, much better shape.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree with both of your takes there. And certainly I think that is really sound counsel for a lot of folks out there, that either if you're going through an exam right now, or maybe you're going through, you know, an inquiry that maybe has even come down from enforcement, to the extent that you can help remediate that situation, that is only going to advance your position and the potential that you're able to walk away without things getting escalated in a much, much better and more efficient fashion. Let's start to kind of maybe, as we think about kind of winding down our conversation and maybe start looking towards the future, you know, here a little bit. And one, I guess maybe we'll stay with the present for one last question, and then I'm going to ask you guys to put on your, you know, best soothsayer hats here and look towards the future a little bit. But, you know, how are you seeing firms kind of interacting with the staff right now? What's that dynamic and staff, by staff, I should say, with the Division of Enforcement, you know, specifically, you know, are you seeing what does that dialogue look like? What has the kind of that dynamic between the industry and the staff been, and what are you seeing out there in the space?
Right now, nothing. we're recording this during the government shutdown, so there's very little activity now.
I teed that one up too perfectly. That was too easy. I set myself up there. I blame myself.
Yeah, no, look, I mean, my take is I think coming into the new commission, I think, like, with a new enforcement director and interim director, I think a lot of the stuff that was going to get cut got cut already. I think I know a lot of letters went out terminating investigations. Obviously, we've all seen the news on what's happened with the crypto litigations. Like, we know there's a lot of effort probably on the defense counsel side in getting investigations cut off. I think we're getting to the point, though, now that we have an enforcement director in place who, frankly, is, I think, a very positive for the staff and positive for enforcement, someone who comes in without an agenda, who seems to be very smart and is listening to the staff and is listening to the policymaking divisions, is helping kind of guide the staff and is supportive of the staff. And so I think they're going to do what they've typically done in cases. And so I'm not sure the interactions are all that different. I do think you could probably be a little bit more pushy on process and making sure that you do get sufficient record information in the record during a white paper or a Wells process. You could kind of push on some of those points perhaps. But otherwise, I think as a general matter, You know, I would say the same thing that I've always said is like, which is, and I think the staff thinks of this too, or at least my old team did, was do early presentations to the staff. If you could off-ramp the case early, off-ramp it early. Like the staff doesn't want to investigate for 2 years and not bring a case. And, you know, they, if there's no case, they want to know about it quickly, if there are facts or law that, that needs to be brought to their attention. So I would just do that early and then just be transparent. I think the staff, we always told our team to be transparent on cases if, you know, where appropriate. Sometimes there were circumstances where you couldn't do that, but where appropriate to be transparent. So I think a lot of it is kind of continue doing the same, but Kurt's done this way longer than I have on this side. So Kurt, what do you think?
No, I agree. I don't think there's any reason to really change how you're interacting with the staff, right? If 3 months or 4 months ago, you thought you had a sort of marginal case that ought to get kicked out, you probably should have had that conversation already. But generally, you know, I don't think it's beneficial to go in and like pound the table and tell the staff why they shouldn't be doing this investigation or thinking about an enforcement action because of this, that, or the other sort of, you know, policy reason or the way political winds are blowing. I don't think that's often well received by the staff. I do think perhaps you maybe have some new arrows in your quiver if you get to, let's say, the Wells phase of investigation, or you're, you know, making a proffer to a senior management, and you can say, look, as a policy matter, maybe we don't think that this particular matter aligns with what this commission wants to do, or maybe the penalties that they intend to recommend seem a little bit inappropriately calibrated in this commission, right? I think those types of arguments are fine to make in the right way and at the right time. But in terms of interacting with the staff, for me, it's the same. I completely agree with Andrew. I want to try to get in front of things. If I can go in and proffer early or give a presentation and try to help the staff understand my client's perspective, I'm always going to take that opportunity. And that's no different now than it was in the last administration or the one before.
I think that's such really great advice from you both. So I'm just going to underscore it, because what essentially, like, when you break that down in the first example that you gave, Kurt, and you alluded to this too, Andrew, which is why I'm highlighting it. It's like what you're saying in that first example is like, I don't think the stuff that you're doing is important, and the stuff that you're looking at is important, and the stuff that you're looking for is meaningful. And in reality, it is. And it's just that what in the second version of that that you said so kind of articulately, it's like, what you're looking for with our specific case doesn't align with the mission or the purpose or the other thing that you're trying to get at here. And that is really impactful. And I think that does carry a lot of weight. And certainly, even as Andrew articulated, like, the staff doesn't want to bring a case and work for 2 years and do a bunch of stuff and then get to the end and say, oh, yeah, you're right. Like, these facts are differentiated from these other types of cases that we're bringing.
Right. Or thanks for giving me your advice of counsel defense at the last hour.
Right.
Like, that's the part that always killed us. Yeah. Like, just, you should have told us that early, guys. Like,
No, that's good. All right. Well, so I've got one more question for you, and then we can wrap up today. But again, this has been awesome conversation. So, with all of this review over the last 12 months, and then even bringing us up kind of now to the current state, you know, where do you see enforcement going? Obviously, we're going to be awaiting those final numbers so we can come back and judge you both super hard on whether you were right on where the numbers finally came out. But even apart from the numbers, you know, just from a practical standpoint, from a kind of focus areas or priority standpoint, where do you see the SEC Division of Enforcement?
Yeah, I'll take first swing. So, like, for me, my take is, hear everyone saying Ponzi schemes, offering frauds, insider trading. I think you got to look deeper in terms of what this commission is actually viewing as enforcement worthy. In just the advisory space, Patrick, you've got The custody rule. Every last commission, every time was a 5-0-4-1 vote, and we've already seen one custody case this commission. We recently saw our first marketing rule case under this commission. Again, last commission, all 5-0-4-1. And the case here was a substantiation case that they couldn't substantiate their statement that we refused all conflicts. Putting aside what it means to refuse all conflicts, I like to make that comment. The fact that it was actually written correctly in other places, that there were conflicts of interest, that's still, I think, an edgier case to be brought in the marketing rule space. We see conflicts of interest cases involving large retail advisors about compensation to the FAs and what their incentives were. We saw a significant case, Patrick, we talked about this with you, about a private fund advisor for not disclosing practices and conflicts around post-commitment management fees and whether the impact of deferring transaction costs and collecting interest on it and not offsetting the management fees by that amount. So I think we are really seeing in enforcement cases that would typically have been brought under the last commission being brought under this commission. So I would say look at the commission votes, and I think we're going to see a lot of the same. I don't like whether what the proportion, the ratio is a little too early to tell right now, but those do seem to be cases that are being brought. And as I said before, I think this commission has a very, very smart division directors. And I think enforcement will connect with those division directors to support potential enforcement action. And I think if there's the support by the divisions, I think that, who I know are coordinating generally with the commissioner's offices, I think we'll see similar cases as we've seen before.
I tend to agree. I teach a class on securities enforcement at University of Richmond School of Law. And one of the things we do every year is look at how the SEC enforcement cases tend to break down year after year after year. And what you often see is they cluster in the same places, right? You're always going to see broker-dealer and investment advisor / investment company cases. That's probably going to be 15 to 18% of your docket year after year after year. You're always going to see issuer reporting and disclosure cases. You're always going to see securities offering cases, right? Like that right there is going to be the bulk of your caseload every year. I don't think that's going to change at all. Now, maybe we'll see fewer of them or fewer cases around the edges, right? I think where people take issue with some of those cases is where it feels like a stretch case, or you're not sure, was that really a misrepresentation? Was that really a material omission? I don't think we're going to see those kind of cases where, you know, people really kind of disagree about whether the fact pattern warrants the charge. But I think generally we're going to see those buckets. The thing that I keep hearing people talk about is this sort of amorphous phrase, market manipulation, right? I'm not sure exactly what that means. Sometimes it's insider trading. Sometimes it's not. It's almost always cherry picking, right? But I think that means, and I said this phrase earlier, the clean fraud cases, right? All the cases where people can look at it and you just immediately know that there was some kind of fraudulent activity going on there. That could be retail investors. It could be senior investors. In some cases, I'm sure it could be like some kind of pump and dump Ponzi scheme, affinity fraud scheme, right? But the fraudy fraud, I think, is the one bucket that might start to be a little bit bigger when, you know, 5 years from now, we look at the chart year by year for what we saw during Chairman Atkins' tenure.
I think too, just to add on, I think the movement of retail money into private funds, which this commission is encouraging, will also be a reason for why enforcement and exams will continue to focus on private funds. We've already seen rumors about exams happening in interval funds. I think it's going to be a way for enforcement to keep their foot in the door on private funds, because I think if you want retail money in there, you do need to make sure that people think there are guardrails. Otherwise, they may be less likely to invest in those private funds. So I do think we're going to see some efforts. I think those enforcement actions will take a while. Enforcement actions take almost 2 years or so to bring on average. It's going to be a little while, but I do think we're going to see activity in that space.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really, really smart comment. I really think all of your comments have been spot on. It's funny, Andrew, every time I hear people talk about that enforcement case where it's like, we refuse all conflicts. I immediately think of Michael Scott declaring bankruptcy, like, I declare bankruptcy. Like, I refused all the conflicts. But, you know, gentlemen, I can't thank you enough. This has been an incredible, incredible conversation. Really, thank you both so much for spending some time with us today. I wouldn't be doing my job, though, if I didn't ask you at least one quick, fun question, because as we like to say, no good deed goes unpunished. So we're now several weeks into fall. As Mr. Dean noted, we are in the government shutdown. We will avoid the shutdown talk. But since we are into fall, what is your favorite fall time activity? Can be anything.
And that's tough for me. I will say I really do enjoy, you know, it starts to get a little bit brisk, sweater weather, right? A little fire pit in the backyard, yes, with some family and friends. When I have time on a Friday, perfect, perfect thing to do in the fall. I look forward to it as, you know, August gets too hot. I'm ready. I'm ready for that crisp fall night.
Love that. Mr. Dean.
I lived in New York City for almost 20 years. I grew up in the suburbs. As soon as I moved into the suburbs in 2018, Halloween became my thing. I decorate the house. I do nice. The attack the house theme. I take the skeletons. I have them hanging off the windows, on the roof, trying to get into the house. Scares the bejesus out of the kids who walk by. But I also have a smoke machine. I put on the smoke machine. First year I did it, neighbors came running down the street thinking the house was on fire. So we avoided the fire department being called. But I love Halloween. That's actually like, that's fun.
That's awesome. So currently at the Hayes house, there's a giant skeleton unicorn that frames our entire house because I've got three girls. Sorry, guys. I couldn't avoid it. And then second, I love a good fall fire. Get some s'mores going. That sounds.
Yeah, that sounds delightful.
That sounds legit. Gentlemen, thank you again so much for coming on the show today. Really awesome conversation and looking forward to having you both back on the podcast here at some point down the road.
Ton of fun. Thanks for having us.
And that will do it for today's show. I'd like to thank our sponsors, CALFI and the National Society of Compliance Professionals, and extend a big thank you to our guests, Andrew Dean and Kurt Wolf, for coming on the show today to share their fantastic insights on the current state of SEC enforcement and what to expect in the future under new leadership. Please join us again next time on the Securities Compliance Podcast, where we help you put compliance in context. Please check us out on LinkedIn. You can search for Compliance in Context Podcast or on X using the handle @ compliancepod. You can like us and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or go to complianceincontextpodcast.com to listen and learn more.